is I've moved several of the drugs and vice division officers back full-time to patrol, and the rest of the ones that are there right now are rotating in and supporting patrol, so they're not able to address that as robustly as we've been able to in the past.
But Portland School Board Member Paul Anthony is here as well, so appreciate you being here. Dante, some comments?
Yeah, thank you. A comment and maybe a question each for CBO and the chief. Just a comment on the body cameras. In my conversations recently with the chief of police in Oakland, Oakland is in its 12th year of being under a settlement agreement with the DOJ, and they hope to come out of it this year. But in my conversations, everyone on the department, in the department, has a body camera. And he significantly showed, data-wise, the reduction in use of force details of the members of the police force, as well as the numbers of complaints that the police force has received from the community. So in relation to the trust Mr. Weatherwater was talking about, I think he has seen that trust has begun to grow based on some of that, based on the body cameras. The backlog of applicants waiting on background, I think the data in here says that there was about 94 completed based upon getting through the process. And when I checked, I think 96, and when I checked with personnel yesterday, there was still about 90 left to go. Have you seen folks being pulled away by other departments and other jurisdictions within that time frame, specifically people of color and women, because they receive an offer while they're still in waiting here in Portland? And then quickly to CBO, kudos for recommending $250,000 to do outreach and marketing, et cetera, which hopefully will gather more applicants. But then how do you reconcile that with only offering half of the backgrounders to try to do something with that bottleneck with that limited amount of backgrounders? So I don't know who wants to go first.
So on the backgrounders, there really is finite resource for general fund ongoing without requiring further service cuts in other bureaus or not funding some of the other items that we did recommend funding for in the Bureau's request, or taking offsets within the Bureau. So, you know, that is a concern to not be able to have enough backgrounders available. But at this point in time, with the other pressing needs, it seemed like this is the best way we can get at that, is to have better applicants through a recruiting process ready to go and wait for that background. In addition, there is potentially, and it's, you know, would need to be closely monitored, but if there is any current year savings or one-time resources the Bureau could use internally to fund limited-term background investigators to get through the hiring process. So those were all taken into consideration when we were making that final recommendation. For body cameras, there is a lot of research on the accountability that is being done and the positive impact that those cameras are having on communities, particularly for trust building and for outcomes with officers in the jurisdictions that have gone into body camera programs. It really comes down to having, again, another anywhere from $800,000 to $1 million available to invest in that program. If it is an investment, I would strongly encourage that the Bureau have a significant evaluation component built in so that this Bureau could be able to realize what those impacts are and see what the outcomes of such a significant impact would be or investment would be.
I just want to answer the first question about drop-off in the pool of applicants.
Yeah, I might grab one of the assistant chiefs for some of the community members. And yes, we are. I kind of look at it as kind of like we have a 10-lane freeway. We get people into the process. They start. They take the test. They go to the ORPAT, which is the Oregon Physical Abilities Test. They go there. Now, we have a traffic jam when it comes to the background. And so what happens is people on the lower end of trying to get hired, they'll take a different exit, basically. They'll get off at a different exit, whether it be Tualatin, Tigard, Washington County, or Seattle or King County. They're going to get off because the first one that offers them the job, they're going to take it. Police jobs are hard to get, and so we are losing people. Our background process is one of the slowest, and I'm actually kind of not proud of it per se, but what happens is that we're in kind of a staffing crisis. But one thing I don't want to do is to lower our standards and 10 years from now have a lot of problems with the police officers we're hiring. So we're going to stick with the stringent background check, and we are going to lose some folks to go someplace else. And the only way we can really solve that is to have a bigger off-ramp, which means we're going to need more background investigators to slow down that, or actually to get that backdrop or that backlog sped up a little bit so people aren't dropping out. So it's really amazing watching. We get a lot of folks in the seats, but when it gets to the background, that's where it starts to slow real quickly.
Why do 50% of them drop out before? I mean, the first round, your subtotal here, 50% of the applicants drop out.
Yeah, I guess. So what you have, just give it, best way I can do is give an example. Say we have 500 sign up. And so if you have 500 people sign up, some folks are signing up just to meet some obligations, maybe for unemployment. So those folks aren't going to show up to the test. Some folks are going to, during between the time they sign up and before they take the test, they're going to say, maybe I don't want to be a police officer. Some folks, one of the things we do is when we have you sign up, you also do kind of a pre-psychological screening. And that pre-psychological screening eliminates a lot of folks, too. There may be some drug use issues. There may be some maybe some arrest issues, things like that. So we lob them off there. And so right now, out of 500 that might sign up, we may only send 300 to the background. And out of those 300, we'll get about 30 people. So about 10% of the people that get the background actually pass the background. So there's a varied reasons why people drop out. And some of them during that hiring process get hired by somebody else. So there's a number of reasons why people leave, but only about 10% make it through our background. One interesting point is that even with laterals, we have laterals that want to get hired at the Portland Police Bureau, and our background is so thorough, we find things that their department should have found in the first place. So we dig hard because we want the mentality and the complexity of the Portland Police Bureau, you know, how we work and issues that we face requires a different police officer than someone who might work in a suburban police department. And we pride ourselves in hiring the best of the best and people that can deal with complex issues. So that's why ours takes so long. And there is no polygraph.
So if I can just push back a little bit. I mean, the city has passed an ordinance banning the box, you know, conditions, relaxing the conditions under which we will consider hiring people. The state passed legislation. We don't have an equivalent. From what you've just said, our hiring is as strict as ever. And if you have a marijuana conviction on your record, if you've bounced a check, you can never be a police officer in Portland. And that doesn't seem right in today's environment.
Yeah, just because you have bad finances or if you use drugs is not an immediate disqualification. There has to be, if you committed a felony, you are disqualified from being a Portland police officer. If you have recent drug use, you are disqualified of being a Portland police officer. We have certain requirements, but you can have things in your past. And the biggest thing for us is how long ago were your misdeeds or how long ago were your mistakes. So it's a longer discussion. There's a lot. It's not as black and white as, oh, you've had a marijuana conviction and we can't hire you. That's not the case. It depends how long ago it was and under what circumstance. We take a bunch of things into consideration. I'd be more than happy to talk more about that. But one thing that I have learned in my current position is that many people make mistakes in their life, and we are willing to overlook those things. It depends when they occurred and if you've learned from those mistakes. So that's why our background process, it takes a long time to dig all those things up. And we have a number of references we check into to find out what kind of individual you are. And if one day I'd be more than happy to have a whole discussion about our background process, but it is not as black and white as it sounds.
Dan, can I pick up on that for a sec? So let me give you an example.
Okay.
I guess I have some familiarity with the federal service. And for example, when you're being vetted for a federal job, I think the rule is for certain jobs, they look back 5 years or whatever. There's a window where they look to see if it's proximate. So that's one test. But another thing is, let's use the example of federal agencies that want to hire positions that require congressional approval. What often happens at the federal level is people get hired as a special assistant pending the completion of a background check, I guess by the FBI, and then a confirmation proceeding, which is we all know from watching TV, confirmation proceedings are a wild card with very few sideboards. But so there's a system in place to capture talent, put them in positions in the lane so that they can, you know, you don't lose that talent, with the uncertainty about what might happen around the confirmation process. Is there something similar to that that we could do with people that we've targeted as, we've identified as big upside, but we haven't completed the due diligence, where there could be some interim position so we don't lose them at the front end, and yet we take some of the risk that it may be at some point a disqualifying something happens, but we've got them in the pipeline and we've put them in a position where they might be able to succeed?
Yes, what we have is, so there's various types of, so when you're doing the background, it usually comes through me eventually, and we have something called termination. Termination means that their background is so bad they cannot be a Portland police officer. Maybe it's been a serious felony, maybe a robbery, a rape, or something like that, and they cannot be hired. And then we have several other phases, like do not advance one. That means that do not advance for 1 year. Let this person get some space between some of their misdeeds and come back in a year and test, and maybe we can look at their background again. We have do not advance two, meaning that after 2 years, basically, get your, do really good in your personal life over the next 2 years, and you can reapply, and the Portland Police Bureau then can get you in. So there's something like that. It's one, two, and three. We have either terminate, 1, 2, or 3 years. For people to actually reapply for the job.
Weren't you talking about before the background check? He was talking about that gap between when you see a candidate who you like.
Yeah.
There's a gap between that and the background check. Is there something between, so you like me as a candidate, but you don't know my background. Is there something you can hire me while you're waiting on the background check? And if it comes about clear, I'm already employed.
Yeah, there's a couple things. Yes, we do. We could actually hire that person as a non-sworn individual for the Portland Police Bureau and see how they perform at the Portland Police Bureau as a non-sworn person. Another thing we do, too, is if we hire officers right now, it's a long conversation, but another thing that we do, too, is if we are trying to hire police officers and the police academy is full, we hire that person as what they call an SAS, a senior administrative specialist, and they work as a non-sworn person inside of the Portland Police Bureau until the academy opens up. We also have the reserve program. The reserve program allows, we have had this before, where we feel that people that have taken our test are not quite mature enough yet, maybe not quite where they should be, and we say, we'd like to offer you a job or a volunteer job within the reserve program. And we watch them in the reserve program as reserves and watch them mature. They're always paired with another officer, and we allow them to mature into, you know, being a good police officer, and then we can later hire them as a full-time employee. So there are some things, I mean, exactly what you're talking about, but we do have some intermediate steps that people aren't completely just cut off from the Portland Police Bureau. Does that answer your question a little better? Okay.
What is the average cost does it take to find somebody initially, one of the 500 people, to get all the way through the background check? That's number one. And then if they go to the police academy, how many people get through the police academy? I mean, there has to be some attrition there as well, I would think.
Yeah, the attrition at the police academy is very, very small. Most police officers, one of the important things we do, if we vet them properly and hire the right people, we believe they'll be successful in the police academy. So we have, I mean, as far as like trainees not making the police academy, maybe one or two every 5 years that don't pass the police academy. But there are some trainees who do not make probation. So after the academy, you go through the field training, program, and that lasts 18 months. So we do lose some folks in the field training program as they proceed with their 18-month probation. But it's a very small amount. And I think that has to do with us being good on the front end of getting the right people in the door, because we don't want to waste money and have someone work here for 18 months and then have to terminate them because they don't understand the job complexities.
So if you've got 90 or 131 or 96, whatever it is, ready for the background, you're going to get 10% of those passed. Is that correct?
Correct.
and you are retiring 90 people a year. So it seems like you're losing ground.
Yeah, it's not 90's high. We're looking closer to between 45 and 50 a year, depends. That's on
it's
average.
90 you qualifies, but not that many would retire.
They may be eligible for retirement, but not everyone retires. So we're looking between 45 and maybe 55. It's going to vary. It depends on, you know, what's going on in the country, what's going on with our pay, what's going on with the latest and greatest budget. That's important to the officers. So it could vary. It just depends.
And by the very fact that they're retiring, they've been with the department for some period of time, so they, by and large, would be senior people?
Yes, they're all usually 25 years before they retire on most cases.
What's an average salary at that point?
About the average, the base salary for a top police officer is like $80,000.
Yes.
Then you add in like longevity, which is 7%. Then if they're working like a night shift, you might add another 4%. So a senior officer, you know, with, if you have your longevity and work in the afternoon shift, you know, your base pay could be close to $90,000 or more.
Okay, several years ago they had several that were close to $200,000.
That was overtime.
And my question really is, how does overtime get done? But that's not.
Yeah, overtime does not figure into your pension. That's not pensionable. So if an officer to work. We've had officers that maybe a traffic officer that works every day of their life, night and day, goes to court, making $160,000. Their pension is going to be based on the $80,800.
Thank you.
Chief, I know we have to wrap up because we've got our next presentation, but I want to ask you a question that's probably unfair. And I'm not trying to get you sideways with the mayor, but I want to ask you, I think it's a no-win question, and it's the following. We're all concerned about gang violence, and we know that it continues, you know, at a pace. And so the question I wanted to ask you is, based on all that you have observed and learned about this problem, if we gave you one extra dollar to address it, and you had to put it in the place where you could get the most value for that dollar in addressing the epidemic of gang violence, where would you put it?
Powerful question. I was a part of Portland's original gang enforcement team when the gangs came up from California in the late 80s. And I spent about 8 years on the gang enforcement team. And one of the things that I look at over history and look at things that are going now, there's really several components that impact gang and gang violence. One of them is specialized people that are out there that know the kids, know the families, know the schools. One of the components that's critical is outreach. And another component is, do these kids have other things that they can do? So this year, or last year, a year ago January, when our gang activity exploded, you know, I moved 6 bodies that we didn't have to spare over to help with that enforcement piece there. I would say if you were going to put money on the table, I would actually suggest at this point that it go to Antoinette's office for more outreach.
I had a follow-up on Director James's comments about body cameras, and specifically I want to tie it a little bit to the internal affairs investigators. So, I mean, it's been established in other municipalities that that body cameras do reduce use of force, whether directly or indirectly, and a potential outcome of their being deployed here in the city is that you would have fewer cases to investigate and so when I see the ongoing funding being added to add investigators for DOJ compliance, it makes me wonder if we're not wiser sort of spending one-time resources there, spending ongoing resources on body cameras. Now, I understand that this is only $324,000 as opposed to the $800 to $1 point something million that's required for body cameras. But I do feel that getting body cameras on our officers is something that we should prioritize and as soon as possible. And it really does speak, I think, to the trust issue that we heard about today. I think what I hear when I talk to my fellow residents about this is that could go a long way to restoring the trust that I think that some members of the community feel has been lost to some extent. And so I strongly encourage that. It's not really a question, but and if, you know, if one-time money is used to hire investigators and over the course of time there are fewer investigations, then that may be a way to get you where you need to go.
Rob, I actually did ask that question of the IOD division, and part of the requirement is that everything gets an investigation, a full investigation. Even if you have video evidence, they cannot deny. So in addition, the body camera proposal has a phased-in approach to get cameras onto officers, which may take, over time, could be anywhere from 1 to 3 years. It also is not to put on every officer, and anyone can be subject to an IAD investigation, whether it's a detective or an officer that would not be in the pool wearing a camera. So that is a lot of where we look at that being a required function of the DOJ agreement and why I've recommended ongoing resources.
And just as a final, maybe, I don't know if there's any thought about any cost savings that may result, because we're not making payouts based on suits that get settled by the city. So what's the benefit that payout doesn't bring?
Thank you. Naturally, I have a bias, so I want to say that up front. But if I had the $1 to put in a particular area, I think we have to continue to invest in our youth services division. When it was put together, the issues that are youth-related became in one repository. Prior to that, the citizens didn't know where to go. The officers didn't know where to go. And then you have the officers who are ambassadors for the Portland Police Bureau. There's probably more bang for your buck coming from the Youth Services Division. They are in with our youth. The youth are the future. If we're going to turn this gang problem around, we got to invest in the youth and try to change their behaviors, their decision-making. And then you have the officers who are helping to recruit the future. They are interacting with youth of color, and those youth can talk to their parents. I mean, it has a very pervasive impact, and there's also maybe a bigger benefit for the Bureau than it is for the school district, ultimately. You have Loretta Lynch, who said it was a model program and that she wanted to take back those characteristics and have other police agencies model the Youth Services Division. And then lastly, they have taught, there's been 57,000 youth who have graduated from the Gang Resistance Education and Training Program. And the school resource officers teach most all of those classes. Thank you.
Can I ask just a real quick follow-up on that? Just given your unique situation, head of security at Portland Public Schools and former officer. One of the things that we struggle with a little bit in reviewing this is there was real value in the youth services and the school resource officer program. But the history here, as we understand it, is that up until about 2001, the school district paid for and funded a school resource officer position within the district. And then they had cut that, and the city picked it up. And one of the things the city's very good at is picking up the slack from other governments when they reduce funding for things. We very rarely give the slack back to those other governments. And so I guess sort of the question is there an appropriate model there? I mean, I think there are some benefits that accrue to the wider community and the police bureau, but there's certainly benefits that accrue to the school district as well. And should they be responsible for picking up some of that substantial cost?
Andrew, I've got three questions I wanted to ask the chief. We have 3 minutes left, so could you continue that conversation offline? Chief, here's my three questions. I'll ask them all at once, and you answer as many as you can in 3 minutes. How's that? One is, you talked about the Drugs and Vice Division, and you said a number of officers are now rotating to patrol. A couple of years ago, I asked Captain Kruger, there's about a $4 million budget for the Drugs and Vice Division. How much time do those officers spend chasing drug dealers who we know are involved in, like, violent crime, and how much time chasing drug dealers because they're drug dealers? And he said it's about half and half. So it's like, that to me meant we're spending $2 million chasing drug dealers because they're drug dealers. Given you've reassigned some of the staff, at least part of the time, what would that figure be today? My second question is, I had a meeting with the union executive board a couple of weeks ago, and we wound up spending an hour talking about homelessness. And another question I have for you is, if we cut homelessness in half, that would be, would that, what would the equivalent be in terms of freeing up FTE in the police bureau? How much time do you, I mean, how much FTE is used up sort of dealing with issues that are a direct result of homelessness? My third question is about the Ferguson effect. I've heard repeatedly about the post-Ferguson era. Are there national or local statistics on the percentage drop in applications to be police officers since August 2014?
The Drug and Vice Division efforts focused on truly violent drug dealers versus others. What FTE benefit would we see from a 50% reduction in homelessness? And Steve, what would, restate the third one for me.
The third one is, what's the percentage drop in applications to be police officers since August 2014?
Oh, all right, yeah.
Thank you. With our changes in DVD, I can't tell you the percentages, but I can get that for you. But their focus now is on interstate drug trafficking, major drug dealers. The FTE number for a 50% reduction in homelessness, I don't know that I can tell you that, but I know that it every day our officers are out and doing that work, so it would be a noticeable number. We spend a lot of time every morning, every day, and every evening with the issues that surround homelessness, both in connecting folks to services and addressing the criminal behavior that is sometimes associated with that. The Ferguson effect, we noticed right away when that decision came out in the winter of 14. We had people in our background process that left during that and decided now is not the time for us to consider doing this profession. One of the things that we then saw was we continued to get good numbers when we advertised and posted for testing. You know, we changed our written test to a national testing model that really opened up that bottleneck. What we found is a whole lot of different people that traditionally maybe not had applied for this job in the past were putting in for the job. And so they were not getting weeded out until this background process because we were all competing for this much smaller pool of people and a lot of advertising the smaller pool of people that we're competing for and only being able to get them out in that background process is where we change. So it, not so much like a, that I could say here's a percentage difference, but you know, our number of people successfully completing the background prior to Ferguson and post-Ferguson has been a noticeable change, and it's probably something we could measure and put numbers to. Because it wasn't, at first you might think, all right, nobody's putting in, and that wasn't the case. It was a whole lot of other people are putting in who maybe haven't lived their lives the last couple years thinking about doing a job like this.
All right. Thank you. I think we probably do have to close them out. Let's take one more question from you, Frida, and then we'll wrap.
Okay. First of all, I want to thank you for answering my multitude of questions I had. And sorry, I've negotiated with teachers, so union contracts. Anyway, but on SROs, Commissioner Fish mentioned the gang issue. And for us out in David Douglas, for CBO to understand, we did not have SROs for many, many years. And it was after the city picked up the expense of it that we finally got, we have two. They, at our school district, we feel they're invaluable for to control the gang activity. We have the concentration of poverty there, that should have more gang activity, but the SORs have been very valuable in controlling gangs. So I think you're getting your bang for your buck with them out there. And I don't know Portland Public Schools funding, but in Douglas, we spend almost $300,000 for security officers besides the SRO to control it. We have a little city out at David Douglas of 3,000 students. So it's a little city. And so we have our own security, and the SROs are just, they do a lot, besides also helping with recruitment with our career program. So it kind of multitude. So from a school district standpoint, they're an extremely valuable resource.
Rita, if the Oregon tax measure passes and you guys are rolling in money, could you pick up the cost of the SROs then?
You know, I really hope that happens, because right now we're not rolling in money. So.
Chief, George, team, thank you very much. Appreciate you. Thank you. We're going to move directly to BOEC, I think, as soon as we can change up here.
Good afternoon, Mayor, Council, Citizen Reps, Auditor, Mr. James. Oh, y'all.
Okay, we're going to get started. Lisa Turley, the director of the Bureau, is here. We'll let you have at it with a presentation, please, and we'll have CBO follow you and then get to discussion after that.
Thank you. Good afternoon. My name is Lisa Turley, and I'm the director of the Bureau of Emergency Communications. For the record, I've been director of BOEC since January 2006. This is my 11th budget presentation before council, and it is my last. Just saying. Even if I'm still working for the city, I'm not going to be here. I'm going to send somebody. So, before starting on our request for this fiscal year, I would like to take a few moments to review what BOEC has been able to accomplish over the past years, even while facing cuts or at best, no impact budgets. And then I'd like to take a brief look forward into the possible future of BOEC and 911 service delivery in Portland and Multnomah County. I am the longest serving director at BOEC, and during my tenure, our focus has been on building the infrastructure of the Bureau and building flexibility into the way we do our work. We implemented a program of accountability in performance, behavior, and attendance. We have made progress, but still continue our work on that today. We implemented a new computer-aided dispatch system. This project is a major and difficult transition for dispatch staff at any 911 center, since much of their work is done via muscle memory, and a new CAD completely disrupts that flow and requires relearning and the creation of new pathways. We have implemented two different programs, sweeps if you will, with regard to the way we process calls and which calls we process. The first occurred in 2007 and significantly lowered the number of calls holding over two minutes. The second occurred in 2012. Both programs resulted in significant improvements in service delivery, and both resulted in improving staff time and work effort. We moved from an organization with 170 standard operating procedure documents to one with 25 SOPs and about 180 reference guides, many of which are accessible via CAD commands. This resulted in much greater flexibility in job performance. We have 14 operations supervisors, only two of whom were in that position when I first came to BOEC in 2002. We have a new operations manager and are currently in the process of selecting two new assistant ops managers. This team is ready to take on the challenges of the next generation of 911 service delivery. These are just a few of the highlights of where we've been and the work we've done to set us up for future projects. For example, we're working on implementing a program that is already in place in many hospitals around the country and in the 911 center in Washington County. It's called Just Culture. It's an algorithm-based response matrix, and it takes a broader view of appropriate management response to staff work errors. We have a technology systems team that is managing all of our technology so that changes can be eased into workflow. And just a note, technology does not always make things better or faster. It just makes it different and with different outcome possibilities. We all need to keep that in mind as the 911 telephone technology makes a huge leap in complexity over the next 5 years or so. That new technology will add a layer of complexity not seen before and could lead to increased handling times, which can result in longer wait times. We continue to work on call-taking efficiency, and again, I urge the City of Portland to consider some type of 311 implementation to alleviate non-emergency call volumes at BOIC. We have a training department that is making heavy lift changes in the way we conduct training. The goal is to create building block sets of information that can be delivered in such a way that we decrease total training time while continue to realize effective learning. Today, we have 23 people in training. Basically, that's 1/4 of the operations staff. I will be working directly with Chiefs O'Day and Janssens, as well as our other public safety partners, to more clearly define the work that BOIC dispatchers can continue to perform on radio talk groups. This includes things like placing telephone calls for responders who possess cell phone calls in their rigs. Our staff is at the breaking point of maintaining responder safety or providing services that make the job the provider's job easier. As an employer, we must do better and more in recognizing the stresses inherent in the profession of dispatching and provide individuals tools and knowledge so each person can make the best choices around this area. All of the changes and programs we've done over the past 10 years have made an impact, even with increasing call volumes and decreasing staff, problems that you've heard from the previous two chiefs. We are just now beginning to see more significant rises in call wait times and in calls per agent per hour. And I'm going to pass around a graph that you don't have in your packet that shows that, and you can see for yourself kind of where our problem is. Please type that. Thank you. But we have done all we can in these realms. The bottom line is, in order to address call volumes and the public's expectation of call taker availability, we need more certified staff. Unfortunately, that doesn't happen overnight, but we can make progress. The submitted BOIC budget requests, one, that we be held harmless from the 5% cut, and two, that we be allotted 13 more FTE positions. Our plan is to hold an extra academy this winter, which puts us back on a more stable footing for filling our ongoing staffing needs. I appreciate the budget office recognition of the need to be held harmless and also the recommendation of funding for 9 FTE. However, I believe that recommendation does not go far enough to assure BOIC staff, who invest a significant part of their lives in learning these jobs, that they will continue to have the jobs after a budget cut, and the public that we are committed to making progress and increasing staff, decreasing calls per agent, and decreasing call wait times. With regard to this year's budget, you have graphs and charts and explanations about where we are today, and I'm happy to answer any questions you might have about that information. Thank you all for your time and consideration with regard to our budget. I would like to thank Council for your support over the years, especially Commissioners Fritz and Novick. Finally, I would be remiss if I did not express my sincere gratitude and appreciation to my entire staff, and especially to Jenny Dupree and Gary Bevins for their work on this budget.
Yeah, so I will be brief. Doug Lee, who's the analyst for BOIC, was not able to be here today. So Shannon Carney, who is the most recent BOIC analyst, is here to correct me if I get anything wrong. But I don't think I will. It's a pretty straightforward review of BOIC's budget. So we do recognize the staffing issues that the director has raised and the significance of those, and as a result, don't recommend taking any of the 5% cuts. Again, BOIC requested the 13 positions are about $850,000. We are recommending funding for 9 of those positions, or just under $600,000. We need to talk to HR over the next few weeks about position authority. And I don't think there's a necessarily concern there. We're all in agreement that BOIC needs the funding for the positions. Whether they need the permanent position authority or not, they may be able to get these trainee positions in through double fills and other mechanisms. Because the one thing we do note is that the last staffing study, I think, was done back in 2004. We do recommend that BOAC do another staffing study to sort of look at what the optimal size of the bureau is. It's very clear they need the resources for those trainees and staff right now. The ultimate size of the bureau, I think, is an important question before we add the permanent positions in ongoing in there.
Okay, Rob.
So I noticed that CBO was recommending that staffing study that you were talking about, Andrew, and I was just wondering if your thoughts on that was that they would do that within their existing budget, because there wasn't a separate line item to fund that, right? So, and given how lean things are, I was wondering if that was really a realistic expectation, that they would just find a consultant to do that for them and not pay them very much, or...
I can address that, sure. So that was in Doug Lee's recommendation. I think the amount for a staffing study could be found in BOAC's contingency, and that would be an appropriate use of BOAC contingency funds.
Sorry, I had one more, but this one's for you. Reading the report made me wonder about the staffing situation to the extent that, so everyone who works at BOAC has to be trained here because you service so many different, so you can't just find people in other places. Even if they were trained elsewhere, they'd have to be trained here in order to be competent here. Is that right?
Right. All of our staff go to a two-week course down at DPSST in Salem. But, yes, every 911 center pretty much does their own training because you're learning your different agencies. They have different policies, so you have to dispatch to those policies or call take to those policies. And you have to learn how to use the CAD. When I first started dispatching, we used cards, and it was really easy to do that because everybody could write on a card. This computer is like a brain, and they have different keys mean different things in different situations, and you have to do the commands in the right order. And so, yes, it's very intensive on the job training.
To look at that from service metric point, you don't have problems with poaching then so much because anybody who leaves has to get trained somewhere else.
Correct. And we do have a lateral position, and we do bring people in, and they're typically good dispatchers because they understand the culture of a dispatch center, but they do have to forget what they know and learn something new.
Sure.
One question. I'm sorry I had to step out of the room for a second, but I know from our executive session last week, I know there's a chronic shortage of trained dispatchers and call takers. And I'm just wondering, you know, you can look at any TriMet bus and you see these big recruitment signs out there for police officers. How come we don't see anything like that for dispatchers and call takers?
That's a great question. We have actually looked at TriMet buses, but we tag along with our larger brothers, big brothers and big sisters, and go to some of their recruiting events. And we're very active with, for example, the Albina Ministry, and we have contacts there. And we do nationwide recruits with APCO NENA, which is our partner agency. We actually also recruit on Craigslist.
And just a couple of points, but let's follow up on that one. Lisa, do I recall correctly that we used to be able to get more of our dispatchers to go out to job fairs with police, fire, et cetera, and it was something overtime they volunteered for, but now people are working so much forced overtime, it's harder to get people to do that.
That's exactly correct. We have people are burned out. They are working way too many hours.
One other thing I wanted to touch on is that we need to, I mean, we're seeing higher level of turnover in the Bureau than in years past, which means we have to have more people in the training pipeline to replace those people as they drop off. To some extent, the higher turnover is a result of our being in the situation where we have lots of forced overtime, so people are burning out quickly. So it's conceivable that if we reached a point where we had the appropriate amount of staffing, then the turnover might be reduced and the number of people we need to have in the pipeline might be reduced. A countervailing factor, though, that Director Turley has noted is that she expects that there will be fewer people as in the future who are thinking in terms of signing up for the same job for 30 years, just because there's fewer people in all of society doing that. So it may be we're in a particularly bad place now where we have, you know, fewer people wanting to work for 30 years in one job, but also a stress situation which results in more retirements. But
So it could get better than it is now, but there's this long-term countervailing factor that might mean that, for example, I think the last staffing study said that we should have 107 certified staff and 13 trainees. It may be that in the future, the ratio of trainees to certified staff is going to be higher because you're just going to see more turnover always.
Director Turley, I have a couple questions about your laterals and the pools where you recruit. So could you just give us a sense of where some of the best talent is? And I'm thinking people that do this work in other cities that have decided they want to move to Oregon, or people that have a military background, or you can think of lots of different fields. But where are you finding some of your best candidates from in terms of laterals?
Right. We have had several successful folks from California, and I think they have experienced similar movement of people that we do, and their training is very similar to ours. We've also seen quite a few people from Arizona. I think they're probably escaping the heat. We also have some people express interest from the East Coast, but most of them, for whatever reason, do not end up moving here.
And does given that we're trying to recruit talent and we're in competition, do you have all the tools you need to recruit that talent, including things like some of the soft costs that might make the difference between a good candidate coming here and going somewhere else?
Typically, when we do those kinds of recruits, they have to pay their own trips up here. They have to make at least two different trips right now. We're trying to get that down to one. And certainly, if we could help bring them in, or we've tried Skype interviews, we've done all kinds of different things to try to make that transition easier.
Commissioner Novick, is this a fertile area to look at in terms of recruitment, some of the soft costs that may be the difference between a quality candidate from another state coming here for an interview and relocating versus getting a competitive offer somewhere else?
I hadn't focused on that, but it certainly seems like something we should explore. By the way, on recruitment, another thing that we should bring up is that we don't have as diverse a workforce as we would like. And this is a job that it's a really tough job, requires a lot of training, but doesn't require a college degree. So there should be a wide range of people thinking about it. So we've been trying to figure out how we do, private buses might be one way, but how we do more outreach to communities of color to make sure that people consider this job.
Two comments. You mentioned something about the different bureaus having different dispatch policies. Would it not make sense to get all the bureaus to sit together and try to come up with a more common policy to increase efficiency?
We're not talking about bureaus. We're talking about the different police jurisdictions.
Oh, okay.
So Gresham.
But still, I don't know that rules out that logic.
We do that as much as we can, but for example, and I'm not going to get this exactly right, dealing with juvenile issues. Portland has particular ordinances. Gresham and the East counties may have different, and their ordinance, we have to dispatch to their ordinance. That's why these reference guides tied to the CAD, they can do a command that brings up the juvenile reference guide, and it will show, if it's 7 o'clock in Gresham, it's a crime, and if it's 10 o'clock in Portland, it's a crime.
Okay.
So we do try to provide those kinds of assistance around those little tiny issues that are a factor in how our folks do their work.
Okay, and then the point was on page 6, the residential strengthening program. My guess is that's not going to be approved. But I live in a 1910 house that I am confident is not connected to the foundation in any way. So I had the same contractors come in, and you're absolutely right. Mine was between $5,000 and $8,000. I did it myself for about $600. So I'm thinking, well, if we took these 200 homeowners and got Home Depot to teach them how to do this, the old give you fish or teach you to fish, we could do 200 houses for a fraction of, $600, $600 to $800.
Point out, I think you are in the emergency management.
Yeah, you're in the other.
There will be an opportunity. There will be an opportunity to talk to Carmen about that exactly.
Yeah, let's talk to Carmen about that.
Dodging the question, we demand an answer.
But you have a consulting job coming up.
So if you could indulge me for a moment, I just had one sort of thing to add on what Steve was saying about the expectation of how long people are going to work at their jobs and how that's been. Our expectations are that people are not going to work 30 years at a job anymore. And I think this is obviously a larger philosophical conversation, but I think a lot of the reason that that's true is because there haven't been the kind of good jobs, good union jobs with good benefits that people had in the past. And I would like to point at these jobs as actually being the kind of jobs where you could expect people to work longer because they're assuming that they're the Bureau is staffed adequately and people aren't taking a lot of sick time because they're, you know, they're getting burned out. This could be the kind of good job that we could expect people to work longer. And I think city jobs in general, let me just get on my high horse here, city jobs in general can be that way and they should be that way.
Hope you're right.
Yeah, we hope. I do hope you're right, but I will say that what we see is that in 2008, the state and PERS changed the opportunity for dispatchers to retire at 25 years instead of 30. So people that we thought at the time would get through and who said they were going to go through to 30 have that's the bubble we're in right now. Just like police has their bubble, the bubble we're in right now is that those folks have elected to retire at 25 years.
Lisa, thank you. Do you have something
else for you? Go ahead.
Go ahead, please.
Director Turley, you mentioned in your remarks about the 311 system, and what would can you quantify a little bit about if we move some of the call taking off of your call takers into a system like that, what kind of pressure that would take off the back end that you're describing today?
Right. Thank you for that question. We take about 1 million calls, not quite 1 million, and right now I see typically between 35 to 38% of our calls come in on our non-emergency public safety line. I believe that some of those calls need to stay with us because they do require a law enforcement, generally dispatch, and so that would still need to come from BOIC. But I would say even if it's 25%, you're talking about 250,000 calls that are being handled by somebody else who does not need to have the level of training that our folks have. So I'm thinking a 250,000 call center, and I think if you had that center, you would be getting calls from other bureaus also, just because, you know, people don't want to call 823-BUMP. They want to call one number, and that's the number.
I just want to note for the record that Director Charlie has assured me that although she is going to retire from this job, if we decide to set up a 311 system next year, she'll be happy to come back to help set that up.
Mine is more about recruitment and being on a school board. Have you considered, I'm not sure where your age starts for hiring and the criteria, but our schools are focusing on jobs that don't require 4-year college. This seems like if the school districts could have that money, the high schools could have, or not money, the information on how to start steering students toward that, it might help in recruitment in the future. Plus, at our high school with 76 language, we have a lot of diversity.
That's a great point. We do have an outreach coordinator, and part of that position's responsibility is to work with schools. And right now, and I'm sorry, I don't know the school that we're actually building a program with, but it's in conjunction with the Police Bureau, that we're already trying to roll that kind of a program out into one and make sure it works before we take it further.
Director Turley, just Dan and I were musing about something. I just want to throw a little curveball at you. You know, I remember once I was driving somewhere with my wife, and she kept on her cell phone, she kept calling a number to get information for a restaurant, a phone number, whatever. And then, you know, later when the bill came in and I showed her that, you know, we're actually being charged for those calls, and it starts adding up. And it's a wonderful convenience that the wireless companies give you, but they actually charge you for it. Are there examples in the country of 311 systems that have a cost recovery component where people know in advance they're going to get charged a quarter or 50 cents or whatever for a call, and it's collected through the phone bill?
Yes, I believe there are. Additionally, the city of Portland could start this and then sell the service to other government agencies and jurisdictions around the region.
Just
you know, just in the abstract, because we have such champions here for 311 on the council, the two things that I hope at some point we look at is, you know, a cost recovery model, and so that people know it's a choice. If it's a service, and if you want it, that there's a modest cost. And second, that because you're dealing with a less sensitive transaction, whether this would fit into our overall plan of providing telecommuting and contingent work opportunities for people that might want to, you know, go someplace, plug in their computer, and work 5 hours or work out of their home office or something, so they don't have to come to a call center and they can work remotely.
Absolutely. And even if it's not working from home, they could work from a nearby park facility, a community services center, something like that, so that they're also available in person.
Thank you. Steve, any closing comments? Well, just one for me, just worth noting that you know, we've heard these three presentations. They were grouped today for a reason, obviously. All three of these bureaus are somewhere between challenged and up against it when it comes to personnel issues. And these bureaus represent 2/3 of the general fund budget. So just as a challenge to us all, we got a police bureau that needs more officers. We have a 911 center that is getting burned out from the number of calls versus the number of people. And we have a fire bureau. We have 13 positions that are being paid for by a grant. And this is 2/3 of our, we've just covered this afternoon, 2/3 of the general fund budget, plus or minus a percentage or so there. But that's that makes our challenge all the greater. Any other comments before we?
Just a comment to Lisa and her team that the council definitely hears that there's stress, burnout, and a lot of great work being done. So thank you to your team. And I, for one, am very supportive of the recommendations and to seeing how much more we can do. So thank you.
Thank you very much. Appreciate all your support. So thank you.
Week after next.
Actually, I'm not. No. Christian's giving me a hard time. Correcting me.
We'll
follow up.
Advisors, thank you. Nice job.
Yeah, we do a balancing. It takes a couple of days. All the analysts are doing the thing. We then get together. And there's really a, you know, it's trying to take that citywide look. What are we going to reduce? I don't know what to talk about. So here's the thing. On personal, I think there may be some. It's actually a decision. Yeah. 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 Ye